Hello, it's Wednesday, June 14th, and you're listening to Wing Radio. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing Radio, the black sheep of the alternative media. And before we bring our guest on today, I want to take a moment and thank everybody out there who's participated in our first Wing TV viewer poll so far. The responses we've received so far are exceeding even what I expected. And I just want to thank everybody out there for taking the time. And the results are very, very interesting. There are some things we expected, some things we didn't expect. So we're going to have all the results on Monday. But in the meantime, we're going to keep taking the viewer votes up until Sunday evening. So if you want to participate, go to the Wing TV homepage. In the right-hand column, scroll down a little bit. You'll see it right there. And like I said, we're going to devote our show Monday, or at least part of it, to the results of this. So we hope everybody takes part in it. Now, moving along, our guest today is Mr. Mark Dankoff. And not only is he a correspondent on the Internet, but he was formerly the 36th District Chairman of the Republican Party in Kings County, Seattle. He was later elected as a delegate to the Texas State Republican Conventions in both 1994 and 1996, and on top of that, he entered the U.S. Senate race in Delaware in the year 2000 as a nominated candidate of the Constitution Party. You can also find his website at markdankoff.com. That's markdankoff.com. So we'd like to welcome Mark Dankoff to Wing TV. How you doing, Mark?
Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Victor. Thank you, Lisa. Good to be on.
Good to have you.
Yeah, like we said before the show, there's not enough hours in a day to get everything in, so we appreciate you taking a little time out of your schedule. Now, before we jump into some questions here about what's going on in the world, let everybody know how they can find your website and what they're going to find there.
Well, if you go to my website, which is, again, www.markdankoff, markdankoff.com, you'll find a series of things there. You'll find my biography, of course. There are a series of book reviews and articles that you'll find on my articles and essays page. A particularly valuable aspect of my website is what it leads you to that doesn't involve me necessarily, and that's my links page. I have a series of news agencies listed there, paleo-conservative agencies, libertarian news groups, and news agencies that cover the Middle East and Iran specifically. So there's a pretty good potpourri of things there for the reader to get into that, again, will lead you away from my webpage into a series of other sites that have a lot of good information in them that you're not going to find in the corporate news media, of course.
All right, very good. And we urge everybody to take a look at this material. Now, Mark, to get things started here today, the big news in the mainstream media was George Bush. He made President George Bush, and he made a surprise trip to Baghdad, real hush-hush. What are your thoughts in the year 2006 compared to a few years ago when George Bush landed on that carrier? The big sign was behind a mission accomplished. Where have we gone from mission accomplished to the middle of 2006?
Well, I remember the day he landed on the Abraham Lincoln very much because it was on the 1st of May. I believe it was the Saturday. I happened to be a Lutheran clergyman, and I was at a conference in New Jersey that day with another pastor who had graduated from Wheaton College, unfortunately no longer living. And he was very much pro-war and pro-Bush. I was on the paleocon, conservative anti-war end of the spectrum where this whole thing was concerned. And we watched that landing together and had a very detailed conversation about the situation. And to make a long story short, I have to affirm what Pat Buchanan said at the time, which was that we would win the initial conventional phase of the conflict. Mm-hmm. We would then proceed to lose the occupation, and that's precisely what happened. Many of your listeners will recall that Lawrence Lindsay, who at one point was Bush's Treasury Secretary, was fired for disagreeing with the administration's estimate that this war would cost no more than $50 billion. Lindsay said it would cost $200 billion. My understanding is we're already at $300 billion and counting. And between Iraq and Afghanistan, those two conflicts are costing us $9 billion a month.
Exactly.
Not to mention our own loss of life and the loss of life in the various factions that are involved in the civil war in Iraq. So the whole thing is a loser all the way around. which I think would be a disaster for a variety of reasons, including the mess that we're already in Iraq.
Mark, my question's along these same lines. Yesterday, the House approved an additional $66 billion for military operations in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and combined with previous bills, the numbers are reading $320 billion for the three-year war chest tally for Iraq, and the Dems are saying $450 billion has been spent on the war so far. So considering that they've asked for $50 billion for the war for the budget year beginning October 1st, that's only supposed to last. The funding's only supposed to last through the early part of next year only, and then Bush is supposed to, he's expected to ask for even more money after that. Considering that the major combat operations supposedly ended in May of 2003, why is the cost of this war spiraling even higher on a monthly basis now?
Well, I think it's because the resistance to the American occupation is a lot stiffer than was obviously anticipated by the neoconservatives who wanted to involve the United States in this war. It's a never-ending situation, and we're now, of course, hearing things going on in Afghanistan, both in Kabul and Kandahar and in the southern part of the country, that indicate that that war was not won either. So we've got a situation where when you're in a no-win war of counterinsurgency and you're continuing to be involved in air and ground operations on a monthly basis that you weren't planning on being involved with, the costs are absolutely going to spiral. I think Paul Craig Roberts said in one of his columns that the administration had miscalculated the cost of this war by something like a 2,850%.
Wow.
You might have to revise that estimate upward after listening to the figures that you just cited.
But boy, they were right in the ballpark.
Probably spending, who knows, at least $108, if not $110 billion a year on this, and I suspect that that's going to rise even higher as we get into this thing with Iran.
They're spending it faster than they can print it.
Well, yeah, and I think it's important for your listeners to understand that where is this money coming from?
Right.
Obviously, the Federal Reserve Board can fire up the printing press. The other thing is I've seen some of the responsible statistics, even in the mainstream international press, on the amount of money that the United States is borrowing from foreign banks to finance this operation, particularly from communist China. So when you start looking at the role of Asian banks in particular, in financing this operation, it's very clear that we have a combination of debt and the printing of funny money to keep this thing going. And the international community, I think, has figured out that at some point the bubble's got to burst in terms of the debt that we're running up on this thing. And this is why I think you're starting to see stories coming out of a variety of different publications abroad that indicate that a number of countries, Russia, I think, is the most recent, to begin divesting themselves of some of their dollar-based investments and to move more into euros. It's a very ominous sign. The St. Petersburg Times ran something on this, I think, 2 days ago.
Well, Mark, reading your bio and how much involvement you've had in politics, I think you're the perfect person to ask these next questions, too. Last weekend, Hillary gave a speech, and she was very vocally chided by the left. This is supposed to be her choir that she's preaching to, yet she was chided very vocally by these people because of her stance in support of the war. It's funny because it doesn't seem that long ago that she was anti-war. So what I want to ask you is, the Democrats have a lot of hope for the midterm elections to capture maybe one House or both sides of the aisle in Congress. But it seems like there's a lot of division now, especially with Hillary and those regarding the war. What are your thoughts?
Well, the Democrats in recent years seem to have had a repeated ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. They did this in the last presidential election when they were trying to run an anti-war campaign with a presidential candidate that had voted for the war. And I think the American public saw through enough of that that it put a major dent in Kerry's efforts in 2004. When I look at this present situation with Hillary Clinton, it's clear that although the Democratic Party should have a major opportunity to take back both the House and the Senate in these off-year elections, it's now an open question as to whether or not they will, primarily based upon things like this Hillary Clinton situation that you cite. To me, when I look at the kinds of things that she's been saying in recent times on this war, I think it suggests a couple of things. think it suggests the influence of the Israeli lobby in Hillary Clinton's personal political agenda.
That's a good point.
Much as the Israeli lobby, of course, has a major role to play in both of the major political parties in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it reflects the fact that when you look at both the Republican and the Democratic parties and some of the shifting that goes on with their major contenders for these presidential nominations, that corporate money and corporate power is always lurking behind these people, so that what appears to be the case is virtually never the case when it actually comes to the policies that these people enact or would enact if they were elected. The same situation with George Bush and the Democratic, I mean on the Republican side of the aisle. I'm amazed at the number of conservatives continue to drive around with Bush stickers in their cars and so forth. And I just say to them, you know, we are running the largest trade and budget deficits in American history. We're in a no-win war of counterinsurgency in the Middle East on false pretenses. Mr. Bush has given us the USA Patriot Act and all of this illegal, unconstitutional NSA spying on individual American citizens. We have unrestrained illegal immigration. We've got a situation where the manufacturing sector of our economy continues to decline. We continue to find ourselves in hock to foreign banks, particularly Asian banks. And all of this has been going on under, allegedly, a conservative Republican president.
I think the fact
of the matter is that people that listen to shows like the one that you and Lisa have, Victor, I think are very aware of the fact that when you start looking at central banking and petroleum interests, when you start looking at the Israeli lobby, you start looking at the Federal Reserve Board, these guys have their bets covered regardless of who becomes the nominees of the Republican and Democratic parties. And ultimately, whatever you think of it one way or the other, I think the late George Wallace has been proven exactly correct on one thing for sure, and that is that ultimately there isn't a dime's bit of difference between the major parties in this country.
Absolutely.
You're right.
The Asia Times has reported that the PNAC, Project for a New American Century, which is the think tank behind this whole Iraq invasion and the global war on terror that Israel plays a central role in, may be closing down. Now, they haven't issued any official statement thus far about this, and supposedly no live persons answered the phone at their offices since late last year, but several of its members have now taken positions at AEI, American Enterprise Institute, five floors above the PNAC offices. So what's your take on this? And if the PNAC is disbanding, what do you predict is the next move on the chessboard for these neocon Likud party Washington warhawks?
Well, I think their basic influence in the agenda will continue. If the Project for a New American Century discontinues officially, you'll see another neocon think tank or a series of them crop up where some of these same players will undoubtedly gravitate toward those operations, much as you indicate that a few of them have already gone over to the American Enterprise Institute.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating thing to look at some of these neocon institutions and some of the major media outlets that have neoconservative sympathies to see that it's a very large interconnected network of front groups and organizations that people travel in and out of at any given point in time. But I think when you look at the agenda of the neoconservatives, the role of the Israeli lobby in all of this, the role of central banking in what the neoconservatives are doing around the world, and certainly the major role that the neoconservatives have played in this war that Lutz Klavan describes as the new great game for oil and natural gas resources. I don't think we've seen the last of any of these people, much as Richard Pearl, I understand, cropped up very recently at the Bilderberg meetings in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you start looking at all of this, these guys are like rubber balls. You push them down and they pop up somewhere else.
Yeah. Now, I'm glad you brought up Israel, and that's going to really be the focus of my next question. But before that, we have to touch upon Karl Rove. And this was big breaking news in the last day or two. And it seems like the Democrats put so much emphasis, they put all their eggs in this basket, that Karl Rove is going to get bounced. And, of course, we weren't holding our breath. We had a little bit of hope that he'd get kicked out. But, you know, again, these people protect their own. And now it seems like that the Democrats are running with their tail between their legs again. And it almost as if they have a defeatist attitude about them now because, you know, they had so much hope on Rove getting the axe, and there he is smiling from ear to ear. So where do we go from here, and Why are the Democrats so... It just seems like they're a beaten horse
again.
Well,
let me add to that, too, Mark. Do you think Roe can skate as easily through potential civil charges?
Well, that'll be an interesting thing to watch. I read the front page story in the Roe situation this morning in the San Antonio Express News. Was not terribly surprised by it because, you know, some of the non-corporate media outlets like Truthout had been reporting for a very long period of time that he would be indicted. I always take a wait-and-see attitude on these things, because mm-hmm. like you folks, I've seen this sort of thing come down the pike too many times. It will be interesting to see if there is some sort of a civil action against him. But it's a little bit like the circumstance that came out recently with the telephone companies and their role in the National Security Agency spying operation against American civilians. What you had, I believe, AT&T and Verizon, and then who was the third company, Bell South,
mm-hmm.
That were involved in this. And, of course, there was talk in the beginning that they would be subpoenaed by the relevant committees in the House and the Senate to explain their role in this whole situation. Finally, that was backed off of, and we've heard nothing more about it since. But much like the Roe situation, there has been talk of civil litigation, class action suits on the part of individual American citizens against these phone companies, but there's been nothing on that I've seen in recent days. So you kind of wonder where these things turn left, when they should go right or down the center of the pavement, and when they simply take a turn that you don't expect and then disappear from the front pages of the headlines. You suspect that something has happened, that there's been some sort of a quid pro quo,
mm-hmm.
or someone with a great amount of power who's been able to keep public accountability out of the equation on these things. And I think with the Roe circumstance, it's simply too early to tell who the players might be that have kept him out of facing formal criminal charges.
Yeah, you know, this whole thing sort of reeks of Kenneth Starr and Bill Clinton, you know, what happened in that fiasco with this thing with Fitzgerald. But how much of a reality do you think this potential indictment ever was? I mean, Fitzgerald does work for the government.
Well, that's right. And much as is the case with a variety of situations, you know, take the Starr circumstance, for example. Howard Phillips, the chairman of the Conservative Caucus in Washington, he and I were talking some years ago when the Clinton situation was very much in the headlines with Monica Lewinsky and the Kenneth Starr prosecution of Clinton and so forth. I said to Howard Phillips at one point, you know, why are they not delving into this whole question of illegal communist Chinese money that quite clearly came into Clinton's last presidential campaign? And Howard Phillips said to me, well, that's very simple. Starr works for a law firm in Washington that represents some of these Chinese interests.
How convenient.
Some of the people on the Republican side of the aisle that have their fingers in this pie, too.
Yeah.
And if Starr were to lift that lid, it would bring a lot of his pals down with him. So I think when you look at things from that vantage point, and then look at this Roe situation and the circumstance with Fitzgerald, it might be another version of what my dad talked to me about many, many years ago when I was a boy. And we were stationed on an Air Force base in Hawaii. My dad took me to Schofield Barracks Army Base to watch some pro wrestling. My dad went on to explain the pro wrestling was fake and everything was choreographed and the people who were in on it knew who were going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And that the whole thing was not rooted in reality at all. That's the model that I've come to use in looking at some of these political situations and media circumstances that we report on constantly, and that is that what appears to be is virtually never the case, and that I think as much as I dislike Franklin Delano Roosevelt personally, I think he's right about one thing, and that is that nothing in politics happens by accident.
You know, it's funny because the last 2 days in the Wing TV articles, the main articles that I wrote, I used professional wrestling as a metaphor, so it's
oh, really?
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up. Now, Mark, let's turn our attention to the Middle East. On Monday, I believe, there was a massive airstrike by the IAF, that's the Israeli Air Force, on Gaza. There were quite a number of innocent people killed, and the defense minister for Israel, a guy named Amir Peretz, says that we will act with all our might and use all our means against any group that acts against us, as if they never did before. Then he continued, we showed the necessary restraint in light of international uproar that resulted, but it's over. What I want to know is, how long is the world supposed to tolerate this evil aggression by the Israeli Defense Force, and how much longer are we to put up with this?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it opens up a whole can of worms in terms of what has happened on both the American left and the American right in terms of this whole question of Israel. First of all, in terms of this situation that transpired with this explosion on this Gaza beach, I find it interesting that in today's New York Times, there's a story on this by Stephen Erlanger and Ian Fisher, where it is very clear, I think, as one reads through this entire article, that the Israeli story and Amir Peretz's story as to what happened on that beach simply does not hold water.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is Human Rights Watch taking strong issue with the way that this explosion happened in terms of the official Israeli explanation, but they quote an American expert named Mark Garlasco, who's a former Pentagon official who did bomb damage assessment for the American military in Kosovo and worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And he indicates, after visiting the beach where this explosion happened, that the crater size, the shrapnel, and the location of injuries on the bodies all pointed to, and I'm reading this, quote, a shell dropping from the sky, not explosives under the sand, unquote. And then he said in an interview in Gaza that he found shrapnel, quote, consistent with a 155-millimeter Israeli shell fired from an M109 howitzer, unquote.
Amazing.
So when you read this whole thing and see the level of Israeli duplicity that is involved in just this latest circumstance, and the fact that it comes out in as mainstream a publication as the New York Times,
uh-huh,
it really makes you wonder how much longer the average American citizen is going to put up with American policy in that region, and what in truth amounts to about a $5 billion subsidy a year,
mm-hmm,
for what Israel is doing in Palestine.
Right.
Of course, the American right is very divided on this subject, I think particularly because in many of the Christian right circles, the role of dispensational premillennial Bible prophecy has played a major role, if not the major role, in causing many American conservatives, particularly those with Christian leanings of one sort or another, to believe that the Zionist state of Israel is the Israel of God.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a dispensationalist or a premillennialist. I take the more traditional Christian view of prophecy, which involved something called amillennialism. And there you have a situation where the Israel of God is in a Christian context, according to the New Testament corpus, is described as comprised of Jew and Gentile who believe in Jesus Christ, and that the whole notion that ethnic, racial, geographic Israel is the Israel of God is something that I think simply contradicts the New Testament. But the Zionist movement has been very, very successful working with people like John Hagee of Cornerstone Church right here in San Antonio, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and the list goes on and on, of spokesmen for Israel in the mainstream Christian right press, electronic and print, which in turn is very much linked up to the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party. And these guys have such a control of these communications organs that they have, at least up to now, have had pretty much a lock, stock, and barrel control of the minds of the grassroots people in their basic constituency. But as more and more of this sort of stuff comes out in terms of what Israel has been doing, Gordon Thomas's book, Gideon Spies, The Secret History of the Israeli Mossad, comes to mind, is a book that, as that hit the American media market, among those who even bothered to read it, I think it opened up a lot of questions as to what we've been supporting since 1948 and what it is that our support of Israel is in the process of dragging us further into in terms of war in Palestine. It quite clearly played a major role, the Israeli lobby did, in getting us into Iraq. And there's no question when you read international media sources, even in the mainstream press, that neoconservatives in the Bush administration with provable direct links mm-hmm. to the Likud Party of Israel are pushing for this preemptive war with Iran.
Right.
So if the American public ever connects the dots on this, there's going to be serious trouble.
There have been reports of American-Israeli paramilitary operations already coming out of Azerbaijan and Afghanistan and other locations. Has this war with Iran begun already? And are they just playing sort of hide-and-seek, not yet getting to the shock and awe part of it that the rest of the world has yet to see?
That is exactly what I believe. I have a friend, Dr. Kaveh Farouk, who is a Persian man on the faculty of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. He is an expert on the Middle East, and specifically an expert in terms of some of the different ethnic groups that are either in modern-day Iran or close to it. And there's really no question in my mind when I read his position paper, which your listeners can get by searching for Dr. Kaveh Farouk and for Rosanna Magazine, which is a Persian website online that's printed in English. You can pretty much connect the dots that in Azerbaijan and in Kurdistan and in Balochistan and in Khuzestan province, just to name a number of places where there has been unrest and significant ethnic strife and so forth, that the United States and Britain and Israel are very much involved in exacerbating these tensions for their own purposes. And I place great credence in the reports that have been put out by Philip Giraldi of Pat Buchanan's American Conservative and also by the American Free Press, which place American and Israeli special forces people right as we speak in Kurdistan and Azerbaijan and Balochistan on the border between Pakistan and Iran. I think it's very clear that this is going on. That, in essence, it would indicate, Lisa, that your question or what your question suggests is entirely correct, that the war has already started. It just has not reached the so-called shock and awe phase involving major airstrikes on Iranian population centers and Iranian nuclear power centers. The other big question in this is going to be whether or not the United States and Britain and maybe Israel make the decision to send in ground forces at some point after the airstrikes begin. Who knows where this is leading, but quite clearly it's already started. The pieces of the puzzle are already in place. And I agree with Frank Whalen of your Republic Broadcasting Network, who basically indicates that he believes that this war is inevitable. I do, too.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't look like we're heading toward diplomacy, that's for sure.
Right. And Frank's a great guy. Now, we see this countdown to war. We see the latest IAEA meetings, the UN meetings, and so forth. And it seems, like Frank says, almost inevitable. If I was talking to you 1 year from today, and we go into Iran within the near future, what are we looking at 1 year from today?
I think we're looking at potential catastrophe 1 year from today if this happens, and I think there's an excellent chance that it will. In the first place, one of the difficulties that we have in this situation with Iran is that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty does permit the Iranian regime to enrich uranium. The whole question is at what level of enrichment. That's where the whole debate centers. The Bush administration at one point simply denied that Iran had any right to enrich uranium. When they were proven wrong on that, of course, then they moved the focus toward the level of uranium enrichment. It seems to me that if there is a series of preemptive airstrikes on these Iranian sites, they would hit one near Tehran, they would hit Isfahan, of course, they would hit Natanz, they would hit a place called Arak, A-R-A-K, they would hit a place called Bushehr near the Persian Gulf. These are some of the major names that keep coming up in terms of the actual sites where these nuclear power plants are located. I think we'd be looking at a situation not simply that where there would be a catastrophe as far as the number of civilian casualties that would be involved in this, but I personally believe that with all of the signs that the Islamic Republic in Iran regime is in serious trouble with its own people, these airstrikes, in my judgment, would be guaranteed to push the people right back into the arms of their current regime.
I agree.
I also think there would be an Islamic backlash against the West from Sumatra to Indonesia that would make our current problems look like child's play by comparison. So I think that we're going down a road, a very dangerous road, and the same people, it seems to me, for the most part, that got us into this Iraq mess are pushing the accelerator to the floorboard in terms of starting this war with Iran. I think that the blowback from it will be absolutely terrible, and who knows just how catastrophic the results will end up being, not only for the entire world generally, but for the United States specifically.
I agree. I'm glad that you brought up your father before, because I was reading an article in which you spoke very highly of your father. He's a retired U.S. Air Force colonel. He had a fine and very distinguished military career. And I'd like to know what his thoughts are on this sham war on terror that's based on a mountain of lies from the lies of 9/11.
Well, to be very, very honest with you, I'll have to provide you with a disappointing but truthful answer.
Okay.
My father is basically a supporter of George Bush, and I think, you know, he believes, and I guess it goes back to his military career. I have known other military officers like him of his generation, others of whom are retired right here in San Antonio, Texas, who have this tendency to support the chief executive regardless of what he does, or how much data there is out there that suggests that his thinking has been flawed or even catastrophic. I think, however, as this whole thing goes on, and as I have talked to him in recent times about some of these matters, as things continue to emerge, that he's kind of caught in an inconsistent pattern of wanting to support the president and supporting the president on the one hand, but on the other hand, seeing the evidence that has been placed before him in regard to the cost of this war, in regard to the problems that we're experiencing in Iraq, and in regard to the dangers of this Iran policy, that suggests that that Pandora's box's lid has been lifted. So on the one hand, he doesn't want to repudiate the president, and he wants to be supportive of the administration. On the other hand, he kind of acknowledges that there are a series of problems connected with this that he did not necessarily anticipate, and he's expressed to me some consternation as to exactly where we go from here.
Yeah.
So that's his position on this thing. He has a different perspective on it than I do, and ironically than my older brother does. My older brother is a very left-wing Democratic trial attorney in the Midwest, a very successful trial attorney.
They cover the whole gamut, huh?
represents the far left of the Democratic Party based in Dayton, Ohio. I, of course, represent the paleo-conservative old right. So our family's pretty screwed up politically. My brother's a leftist. I'm on the paleo-conservative old right, and my parents are Bush Republicans, so maybe we all need some psychiatric help.
A little bit of everything. Well, Mark, yeah. I know Lisa has one more question, but before we leave today, give everybody your website address one more time.
My website address is www.markdankoff.com. You can also find me through Old Right Topic News, which is a news division of BATR, or Breaking All the Rules News.
All right, very good.
You've written, Mark, asking the question, how do those calling themselves Christians justify and support the forcible theft of Palestinian land, and I'm going to paraphrase here, the slaughter of Palestinians, which amounts to a Holocaust on the Palestinian people. Why are the people who call themselves real Christians so silent when it comes to Israeli control of Congress, the executive office, and the mainstream media?
Well, you know, I think it gets back to a misunderstanding about prophecy. I have on my website a paper that was submitted at Westminster Theological Seminary on the history of the dispensational premillennial view of Bible prophecy and the way that these people interpret, in particular, the ninth chapter of the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. I think that this worldview goes a lot toward explaining why they view the Middle East through these particular lenses. Again, many of them are not aware, I'll say, of the kinds of media outlets like yours or mine or Frank Whalen's or Sartre's at BATR News that provide the other side of the picture and the other side of the story on what is going on in Palestine. And it has put Christian conservatives who support Israel in a very, very painful and in my view untenable position of insisting that that the Zionists represent the Israel of God, which quite clearly they don't, and then since 1948, it really goes a long way, I think, toward explaining the lack of credibility that Western Christians have in the Middle East and throughout the world, because the rest of the world sees this and compares it with the statements made by Jesus Christ in the New Testament corpus on how one treats people and how one negotiates and how one expresses points of view in terms of love, and the inconsistency is absolutely unsustainable.
Yeah. Well, Mark, since I have you here, and I want to have you back again sometime, but I'm going to steal a couple more minutes of your time.
Sure.
I'm very conservative in my politics and the way I see government. I want smaller government, less taxes, no involvement in foreign skirmishes, and on and on. Yet, nowadays, people confuse conservatism like that of Pat Buchanan and so forth with that of George Bush. They equate George Bush and his neocons with being conservatives when they're absolutely not. In the last couple minutes, tell everyone the difference between a true conservative and these Bush cronies in the White House.
Well, I think when you look at the Bush neoconservatives, you're talking about the influence of people who believe in one world government and
yep.
globalism. That is a complete departure from what traditional American conservatism has always believed. These are people who support globalist trade treaties like NAFTA and GATT, the
yeah.
World Trade Organization, and the
right.
Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, that are not only destroying the manufacturing sector of the American economy, but
mm-hmm.
again are building blocks toward world government and the eventual eradication of the sovereignty of the United States under its own constitution. Classic example of this was the support of the Bush Republicans for most favored nation trading status for communist China,
yeah.
which was not in and of itself. I mean, it was a bad policy in and of itself, but it, unbeknownst to many American conservatives, it transferred sovereignty over our trade relationship with China from the American Congress to a globalist institution, the World Trade Organization. These are just examples of how the Bush wing of the Republican Party has hijacked the conservative movement.
Yeah.
Conservatives believe in the sovereignty of the United States. They believe in a literal interpretation of the Constitution. They are afraid of centralized authority.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional conservatives would be horrified and are horrified at the notion that this USA Patriot Act is the federal government, the right to engage in surreptitious break-ins of any business that they desire without a court warrant. They're horrified to learn that our National Security Agency has been spying on American citizens
mm-hmm.
without a court review and court warrant. These are all policies, it seems to me, which are designed to take power away from individuals and from local communities and ensconce it not simply in Washington, but ultimately in a globalist bureaucracy that transcends Washington itself. So the Bush people and people who vote for Bush policies are basically voting for more government, not less, more intrusion in their lives, not less, more spending on government, not less.
The polar opposite.
Voting for more debt, not less, and the list just goes on and on.
I mean, basically the polar opposite of what conservatism is. So, Mark, this has been absolutely fascinating today.
It's been a real pleasure, Mark. Really.
We're so glad you came on. Once again, it's markdankoff.com, markdankoff.
And you know what, Mark? I'm really glad that you're hooked up with the Constitution Party. That's who we voted for.
Exactly.
Michael Perutka.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, Michael and I are good friends, and I voted for him, of course, the last time out. Wrote several pieces on Michael Perutka that actually appeared in Al Jazeera, believe it or not, at the time that he was running.
We had him on our show.
Yeah.
And then Howard Phillips and I are also good friends.
Well, yeah, we interviewed Perutka once, so next time you see him, tell him Victor and Lisa said hello. And, Mark, we're going to have you back sometime. You keep up the great work, and just thanks for taking some time out for us today.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Victor, Lisa, thank you very much. God bless.
All right, we're going to be back on Wing. We'll be back on Wing TV tomorrow. Until then, keep your eyes open because there's a lot going on.
And that's markdankoff.com, DANKOF.com. Check it out.
See you tomorrow.
Take care.